In the US, three times as many girls reporting being harassed online or by text message than boys, according to the National Center for Education Statistics.
It's terrifying as a mother of a young girl. I try to instill in her the importance of other things besides the way she looks. And I think if we as adults and as a society talk to our young girls about the importance of their mind and other extracurricular activities and other things besides the way they look, maybe we can make some difference. Maybe we can make a change. Maybe they won't feel as much pressure to judge one another.
According to Tamara, girls are not being put down by strangers online, but people they know.
Now it's not just, oh, the people in my school or the people in my class. It's thousands of people that go on social media and can see this one girl's post about this other girl. And can you imagine how much trauma that would cause that one girl knowing, you know, one of my peers just said this thing about me and it's true or it's not true, but it's out there for the world to see, and how devastating that would be for that young girl.
According to the study by Plan International, one in five girls has abandoned or cut down her use of a social media platform after being targeted. Attacks were most common on US-based media platforms. Here are the statistics. Facebook, 39% of girls polled said they had been harassed, followed by Instagram, 23%, WhatsApp, 14%, Snapchat, 10%, Twitter, 9%, and TikTok, 6%. The survey polled 14,000 girls and young women aged 15 to 25 in 22 countries, including Brazil, India, Nigeria, Spain, Thailand, and the United States. Not too long ago in Australia, a child model took her life due to online abuse.
Thank you to everybody for the overwhelming love and support that the family has received over the last few days. We realise many people have travelled a long way to be with us today, and we appreciate everyone who came along today to say farewell to our beautiful daughter and our beautiful little sister Dolly.
In Germany, two-thirds of the children have smartphones by the age of 11, making it a hub for cyberbullying, especially the abuse of little girls. For years, international entities have tried to rein in the social media apps, almost all of them being large American conglomerates profiteering off of anything on their platforms. According to the British Counselling Group Safety Net, social networks' failure to tackle cyberbullying is risking the mental health of young people. The other problem is that kids aren't talking. Safety Net reports that two-thirds of British social media users said they would not tell their parents if they experienced something upsetting online. This prompted Duke of Cambridge Prince William to take a stance all on his own in this regard.
For me, the issue of cyberbullying and its consequences are personal. My work as a HEMS pilot, air ambulance pilot, has exposed me to the tragedy of suicide and the despair felt by those who've been subjected to cruelty and abuse. Through my work on mental health, I've spent time getting to know parents and children for whom the impact of online bullying has been devastating. And as a parent myself, I understand the sense of loss and anger of those particular families who have lost children after they were the targets of campaigns of harassment. I feel a responsibility to do what I can to help.
But more must be done. The United Nations says that leaders, public figures, and parents must all do more to protect children. Every year on November 20th, the United Nations holds an annual event for World Children's Day. November 20th is an important date for the UN, as it is the date in 1959 when the UN General Assembly adopted the Declaration of the Rights of the Child. It is also the date in 1989 when the UN General Assembly adopted the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Last year's event, the specific topic of social media abuse was touched upon in detail.
I'm convinced that social media doesn't have to be a place of fear, bullying, and harassment. It can bring people together. It can be a place of love and support. Somewhere in the world right now, a teenage girl is being bullied online. She's scared, she's vulnerable, she feels alone. My message to her is this: you are not alone. There are people who care about you, and there are people who will listen if you reach out for help.
No one at that specific event blamed the large conglomerates for the child abuse on their platforms. Simply put, companies are not using profits to protect children. Even the Vatican took note of this, and the Pope called on social media companies to take action. That was back in 2017, and according to Plan International, nothing has changed. Shortly after Plan International published its 2020 survey, Facebook and Instagram said they used artificial intelligence to look for bullying content, constantly monitored users' reports of abuse, and always removed rape threats. Twitter said it also used technology to catch abusive content and has launched tools to improve users' control over their conversations. These methods have proven to have failed, as these platforms might be unknowingly encouraging abuse. Those behind the abuse are getting away with their behavior, according to the survey. For now, it seems that as young girls are catching on to the inaction of huge businesses to protect them, they are just shunning social media. This marks a new trend in an environment where social media and digital communication is being promoted for convenience and, of course, because of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. It shows that girls have simply had enough, and if world leaders and businesses aren't taking the necessary action, then they certainly will.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, and I'm Atta, the host of this program. This series of the program Viewpoints, produced by Brother Mahmoud, is an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, two experts from the Islamic House of Qom. To continue the discussion, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
And Brother Ali Alavian, assalamu alaikum, brother, welcome to the show.
Wa alaykum assalam. Thanks for having me here.
That's right. So, you know, one of the important cases that the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, recently, one of his speeches tackled was the results of the 2020 United States presidential election and the role that it might have or have not in the destiny of the other countries, including the country that is led by him, Islamic Republic of Iran. We know that the Democratic Party, led by Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, won the election. And there have been, of course, some claims about the fraud in election by President Trump, the now President of the United States of America. But and everywhere in the media, when you were looking, you know, they were after the results of this election, that what will happen. Of course, there are still days for Joe Biden to get into the office and start his official work over there. The important case is that different leaders all across the world have sent congratulations to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, but the supreme leaders of Iran approach to this election and the result was somehow different from the other leaders. In a title, he said that the Islamic Republic's well-calculated an unwavering policy in the face of U.S. will not be changed and has not been changed during these 40 years after the Islamic revolution of Iran. Brother Ali, what's your comment on that, and what's your take on that, on the Supreme Leader's opinion regarding the results of the election of the U.S.?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. First, I'd like to, I think if I got it right, I want to tackle a part of your introduction where you said that the leader of the Islamic Ummah said that it does not affect Iran or any other country, but it might affect other countries, the new election that happened in the U.S. might affect the other countries, but the leader of the Islamic Ummah said it does not affect our policies towards the U.S. And it's quite right, because we have seen during the last four decades that the leaders or the presidents of the United States, whether they are Democrats or Republicans, they don't have any drastic difference while they are going to approach Iran and the actually bilateral relations between Iran and the U.S. And all of them almost were the same. So if we want to differentiate between the person who is leaving and the one who is coming, I think it's better to say a person who is living was a person without mask, and the person who is coming is a person who is wearing mask. So we have seen even at the time that this person was the deputy of the president in the previous governments of the U.S., we have seen the pressures that they have put against Iran at the time that this person was the...
Would you name him? Joe Biden.
Joe Biden. Yeah. We have seen that while this person was vice president of the U.S., right after the agreement that was done and happened between 5+1 and Iran, mm-hmm. and then right after the agreement, a day after it, they actually broke it and they started another sanction on Iran. Then the first day after signing the contract. So it is quite clear that from a person, from as he mentions, defines Trump, as Bolton defines Trump, a characterless personality. Mm-hmm. So it expects something like this can be expected. But for a person who tries to show himself as a wise or as a, I don't know, politician.
Okay.
So to break all the agreements that happened recently does not have any meaning. So we have seen during the government of other Democrat leaders that they have the same policy towards Iran.
That's all right.
And there was no difference mm-hmm. In a sense in their relationship with Iran and in their way that they approach Iran issue in their country.
Okay.
So
thank you. Thank you very much. But I'd love to know. But Said Mohsen, for sure they know that any person is different from Donald Trump, because we can say he was like an ideal breaker in the field of politics. In the U.S., we know that, maybe as Brother Ali said, behind the scene, most of the policies and the politics of the U.S. are the same, and they have mapped, we can say, the road that are taken for the Middle East, the Israel-Palestine relation, Iran, and the other countries. But the case is that he was different, you know, and he acted differently. Even now, when he's in the office, he's acting differently. That's why maybe the world had a hope that if he's going to topple down and leave the office and Joe Biden and Harris come, you know, some of their policies might be changed, and we can say. And for sure, the sanctions that this Trump did and the treaties that he left, you know, during his presidency, were many. And we can say in comparison to the previous presidents, you know, it was something new that happened. Still, do you believe that the change of this president in the U.S. Has no effect on the, for example, the situation of the other countries or the policies in the Middle East?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, my wordings might hurt some of the people or the listeners, but I need to say that what I see America, I see that in two main parties. One is Democrats and the other is Republican. I usually say that the Republicans are the thugs and the Democrats are the hypocrites. In America, we have seen this in the history, that there is a system which is obviously running from over the time. No matter either the hypocrites or the thugs, they come into the, you can say like in the administration, the system is there and they have to follow the system. Whoever follows the system, obviously system supports that and then the party wins the election. No doubt there are obviously, there were problems in the election. They were not the true election. As the president himself is saying, like, we have issues with these votings and all those.
Okay, the ballot and the voting.
The ballot
and this
the
claim of fraud.
Fraud as well.
Okay, recounting also.
So
okay.
No doubt these things has happened in America, and this is happening. The problem is there is a system behind it who is doing that and who is basically supporting the Zionist regime. And they bring, obviously, either from the Democrats or from the Republican, a person into to, in the administration, and they, they make him the president as they wish. The main idea is, obviously, whoever comes, he has to follow the system. He has to live within the system. Donald Trump, being from the Republican Party, which I say like they're the thugs, obviously. So the nature of the thugs are that they don't hide anything. They just say whatever they claim. Whatever it's in their heart, they just say it clearly. Hypocrites, they don't say that, those things. They sugarcoat everything. And then they basically tell everything. So the main difference between these two presidents will be, obviously, the Biden will be like Obama or maybe the previous presidents who were from the Democrat Party, who were the hypocrites, basically, and who used to sugarcoat everything and tell, like, people the lies in a sugarcoated, you can say, way. But obviously, the style or the working style of Trump was, obviously, he was whatever it was, he used to say it without any sugarcoating. So for America itself, there might be a difference. They might see a difference in the in their, like, in the style of working. That's what they can see. For the rest of the world, the policies are the same. There is no change in the policies. Neither for the rest of the countries, nor for Iran. Why? It's because the system who is running the whole America, the system under which these parties, either the Republican or the Democrats or other parties, who have to basically rule that country and who have to obviously administrate the, that country, they have to follow that system. The system has specific rules for it. The system has obviously...
Sorry, this word system is repeated a lot. What is this system, brother?
Obviously...
You mean the agents behind the system?
The agents behind the system, the think tanks who are sitting behind it, who are basically running basically the president as well.
The so they're, fund by, they're funded by
they're
the
funded
Jews
by
a
this,
lot, okay?
Yes, obviously they are the Zionist regime supporters. And when I'm saying system, obviously there is a group of people behind it who are running the whole America. They claim that they're running, the, for example, like the whole world, and they're the supreme power. And no matter whoever comes as a president in America, he has to follow their, obviously, orders. And they are living according to them. And obviously, when I'm saying system, it's referred to them. In regards to the, obviously, changes, I said, obviously, there is no change in the policies because the system, those people are there, it's just the president. Front face is changing. It's just like when you are in a company, the company has its own rules, but obviously, board of directors maybe or the manager, he changes.
So
he
you
brings,
have no
he
hope.
Brings, no, he brings a minor changes in his, you know, the change is how to deliver things. the changes in the delivery of those orders that are set by that system or the company. I'm giving the example of company because the company has its own sets and rules and regulations.
Yeah,
it has its own handbook.
Okay.
And then when a manager comes in that company, he makes changes in the way when he has to deliver those orders. In the delivery, there are the changes.
Okay.
There can be a different way, different approaches to do one thing. So in approaches, yes, they are different, but in the main idea that how to run the country, what to do, what are the policies against, for example, the Eastern countries, the Middle East, all those policies are the same. There is no change in the policies.
Okay, that's all right. Thank you very much, Brother
You're
Ali
welcome.
And Sayyid Mohsen. It was very kind of you. And dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Check out our website, parstoday.com/Ian Khalaf Islam page. Also our YouTube page, Khalaf Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Sometimes I can't see where I'm supposed to go. Sometimes I speed up when I should take it slow. But through all my hard times, when I lose my way, you're concealing my mistakes, yeah. I know you're always by my side, never turning out your light. When I need you most, your stars will shine. When I'm out there in the darkest place, worn and tired, I can still see you illuminate all my skies. When it feels like I've fallen too far from you, there you are, guiding me through. Whenever I feel down, you can lift me up, turning my life around with your love. No matter how rough it gets, I can wear a smile, 'cause your mercy never dries, yeah.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثتُ لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another program of For a Better Life. Here on IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi. In the previous program, dear brothers and sisters, we were talking about the envious judge, the judge who was the head judge of the Muslim Ummah, appointed by Mutawakkil, the Abbasid Khalifa at the time of Muhammad al-Jawad alayhi salam. And we saw how envious he became when the Khalifa sided with the young Imam at the age of 25, who had more knowledge than all the other judges. And he went according to the Imam's decree, verdict. and punish that thief. And here he talked about this with his good friend, the store owner, Zaraqa. And the judge said that he would not rest before or until he punishes the imam. And Zaraqa tried to advise him against it, but he did not accept any advice. Why? Because envy had taken over his whole being, dear brothers and sisters. When envy takes over your whole being and you do not control it, you do not manage it, then you will see that you will commit acts which you never imagined that you would do, only because you want to destroy that person. You want to destroy your friend or your colleague or whoever who got the promotion or whoever who was accepted in that university which you also wanted but couldn't be accepted. You were not accepted. And you see that this envious feeling, this envy is taking over. And you do whatever you want to do to harm that person. You want to inflict harm. And this was the same thing that happened with this head judge. So the next day he went to the Khalifa and asked him, the judge went to the Khalifa and asked him, do you know what happened yesterday? Instead of suppressing the person whom a large number of Muslims consider as their imam and as the rightful Khalifa of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, who consider you to be unjust, you put him forward and strengthened him. Those who thought he was the rightful Khalifa are now saying, didn't you see? Even the Khalifa understands that he is higher. They are saying that he is better than others. What a big political mistake you made. He kept making statements like this to the Khalifa until the latter was convinced about killing the Imam alayhi salam. Eventually, they poisoned the imam. You see how the head judge became corrupted because of envy, and that led him to inflict harm upon the wali of Allah, the friend of Allah, Imam Muhammad al-Jawad alayhi salam, and eventually poisoned him.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand there crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Understanding reality will not come from reading books alone, dear brothers and sisters. And this is another subtopic within the topic of envy. Understanding reality will not come from reading books alone. Look and see how many scholars from different fields are in danger of this trait, envy. You see doctors, engineers, and scientists, they are all in danger of this disease which is called envy. But the knowledge that has been praised in the Quran and traditions is a light that shines in one's heart. An example of this is the scholars are the inheritors of the prophets. This knowledge, the knowledge of reality, the knowledge of the mortality of this world and the immortality of the next, is not achieved by reading alone. It is a light that is given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to a person who has prepared himself to receive it. How do you prepare yourself? By reaching that elevated status where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives you ilham, gives you inspiration, divine inspirations, where you will see the truth, or you will feel resentment against these kind of traits. You will not allow these kind of traits to enter your character. And you will try to eliminate all those traits which are negative, and which what we call negative traits, radha'il. And when you have done so, dear brothers and sisters, you will see the illumination coming from within you. When you have reached the level where you are conscious and aware that this is my nafs, my ego, this envy is feeding my nafs right now. This anger is feeding my nafs right now. This lust is feeding my nafs right now. Only then, when you have reached this awareness, can you determine what to do and decide what steps you should take to reach your goal and eliminate these diseases. And if you cannot do it alone, please do ask help. Do go to someone who can help you. Call that person, go to that person who can help you to eliminate these diseases. And we should check ourselves. And I have said it in previous programs also. As you go and check yourself with a doctor, you should check yourself with a spiritual doctor. If you go and check what your spiritual diseases are, only then can you also find the remedy for it. Before you reach a calamity, before you reach and do things where you never could imagine. So let us try, dear brothers and sisters, to practice this in our daily life. As soon as we feel that envy coming within us and trying to take over our nafs, and our thoughts tries to concentrate only on that topic. Why did he get promoted and I didn't? Why did my friend get accepted in this university and I didn't? And so on and so forth. Try to stop it there. Think about the present, not about the past. Not about the future, but about the present. Control your thoughts. And inshallah ta'ala, we will talk more about this topic in coming programs here for a better life on IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. All I need. It's all I need. All I need.
Oh, 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 oh,
your love is all I need.
First suspended, now reinstated, but without the whip. Jeremy Corbyn has been at the center of an anti-Semitism smear campaign that has plagued the Labour Party. How did this begin and what led to the suspension of the former Labour leader? I'm Richard Medhurst and this is The Communique. The Equalities and Human Rights Commission is the UK's watchdog on racism. After years of allegations that the Labour Party was becoming a hotbed of anti-Semitism under Jeremy Corbyn, in May 2019, the EHRC launched an inquiry. Last month, it published its findings in a report. In the report, the EHRC accuses Labour leadership of political interference in anti-Semitism complaints, failure to provide adequate training to those handling anti-Semitism complaints, and harassment of those who complained. In a report that is 130 pages long, the EHRC found two cases of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. Now, granted, that's two cases too many. Anti-Semitism is wrong. Racism is wrong. Nonetheless, this doesn't match the description that we've been hearing from the British media and political establishment for the last couple of years, that Jeremy Corbyn is an anti-Semite or that he fostered a culture of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party and that this was widespread. Those are two completely different things. And when Jeremy Corbyn pointed this out, the day of the report's release, he was suspended.
The numbers have been exaggerated, in my view. The public perception in an opinion poll last year was that one third of all Labour Party members were somehow or other under suspicion of anti-Semitism. The reality is it was 0.3% of party members had a case against them which had to be put through the process. And so I think it's clear that we do not accept, I do not accept, Keir Starmer does not accept, none of us accept anti-Semitism in any form whatsoever in our party.
To talk more, I'm joined by Israeli-American author and activist Miko Pelid. Hi, Miko. Thanks for coming on. It's good to have you.
Sure. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Miko, can I just get your initial thoughts and reaction on Jeremy Corbyn being suspended and his statement that the problem of anti-Semitism was dramatically overstated for political reasons? Do you agree with that assessment? Do you think that's an accurate statement?
Well, I think the accusations of anti-Semitism were all completely and utterly false. They had nothing to do. The attacks against him, which I believe has been in place for at least since 2016, and against all of the people that supported him in the party, in other words, his entire support network, had nothing to do with anti-Semitism or racism. He and all of his supporters do not have a racist bone or an anti-Semitic cell in their bodies. This was a politically motivated witch hunt against anybody who might stand up for the rights of Palestinians, anyone who has progressive views on the issue, anyone who dares to criticize Israel or threaten Israel in any way, shape, or form. And the idea that an activist like him, a man of conscience like him, would occupy Downing Street 10 was, you know, the Zionists' worst nightmare, and they were not going to allow it to happen.
If we look at the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, their working definition of anti-Semitism formed the backbone of the EHRC, and this definition was also adopted by the Labour Party in 2018. Now, underneath the definition, there's a few examples of what they consider to be anti-Semitism. I quote here, denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, for example, claiming the existence of the State of Israel is a racist endeavor. Miko, you were born in Israel. You come from a very important Israeli family. You're Jewish, and you're a very staunch critic of Zionism, of Israel. And you've also said that Zionism is racism. So, I mean, does that mean you're anti-Semitic now, according to their definition?
Yes. Absolutely. But I think it's important to clarify, Zionism is not an expression of Jewish self-determination. Zionism is an expression of Zionist self-determination and the self-determination of Israelis, not of Jews. And so what they've done is they framed it in a way that to defend themselves and also to gag anybody who would dare, who would even think to criticize Israel with this definition. So now if you tell the truth, which is that the State of Israel has no legitimacy and is founded on a racist ideology, you're automatically anti-Semitic. But both of these claims are true whether they call you anti-Semitic or not. But yes, definitely, according to their definition, I am, and many of my people I respect, and certainly Jeremy Corbyn and others, and all the Palestinians, by the way, every single Palestinian is also anti-Semitic.
So, Miko, we know that the neoliberals in the party, the Blairites, have tried very hard to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn. However, how extensive would you describe the role of the Zionist lobby in getting Jeremy Corbyn suspended? Because, you know, a lot of people know what AIPAC is in the U.S., for example, but I don't think they really understand that Israel also plays a political role in the United Kingdom.
Well, there are AIPAC equivalents in every single country in Europe. And obviously, Britain is a very, very crucially important country. And so there are the same kind of Zionist agents working there as there are in the United States. You have what they call the Board of Deputies of British Jews. You've got different Zionist groups within the different parties, the Labour Party and so on. So they work and they actually work very closely with the Israeli embassy. In order, right. And there's no question that as soon as it was clear that Jeremy Corbyn was going to lead the Labour Party, they were going to do everything they possibly could to make sure he would not enter Downing Street 10. And the New Liberals, the Blairites, of course, were great allies, and they were happy to work together. There's no question about that.
Ayelet Namias Verben, she's a member of the Knesset, the Israeli Parliament, and just after Corbyn was suspended, there's a video of her boasting, essentially, that she played a role. She was a piece of the puzzle, as she says, in getting him suspended. What's your reaction to that video? What did you make of that?
It's not surprising because this is well known. I mean, Israel did everything they possibly can, and they're proud of their so-called accomplishment. They see this as an accomplishment. The bringing down of a man who his entire life, who dedicated his entire life to fight racism and fight injustice, is what they take pride in, because the state of Israel represents racism and injustice. And so what is absurd here, that people who represent the state of Israel or different aspects within the Israeli political spectrum, who are racists, who are engaged in a racist, in operating and maintaining a racist state, who are engaged in what can only be described as genocide, ethnic cleansing, and apartheid, are accusing Jeremy Corbyn, who spent his whole life fighting these things, as racist and anti-Semitic. And what is very, very, very worrisome is that they succeeded. They succeeded in a very big way, and the rest of the world is watching this and just nodding instead of standing up and saying, "Are you out of your minds? This is absurd."
Miko, how do you feel that this political witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn fits into the larger scheme of actually fighting anti-Semitism globally?
Well, look, anti-Semitism is a form of racism. I mean, if somebody's an anti-Semitic, they're probably racist against everybody else too. Racism is racism. And so I think what's important is to fight racism and to promote tolerance everywhere, which, of course, this is why Israel is not, as they some people claim, the response to the Holocaust. Number one, most Jewish people who survived the Holocaust did not go to Israel. And number two, another racist regime is never a response to a racist regime somewhere else. What we need is more tolerance. What we need is to fight racism. What we feel is to fight bigotry and to fight and to resist violence and so forth. So, you know, fighting racism is important everywhere. It's a problem everywhere. Racism, anti-Semitism, all forms of racism are problematic, and they all need to be fought with the same vigor, with the same kind of passion that Jeremy Corbyn actually displayed his entire life, and the people around him that were also brought down displayed their entire life. So if people really care about anti-Semitism, Jeremy Corbyn is their man.
Thanks very much for coming on, Miko. Appreciate your time.
Anytime. Thank you.
Jeremy Corbyn has made it extremely clear on many occasions that he opposes anti-Semitism and that it has no place in the Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn is someone who's fought against racism his entire life. He's known for that, both in the UK and outside, internationally. This is a guy who has fought against racism in all forms, against anti-Semitism. He's championed the rights of workers. He's an anti-imperialist. He's an anti-war voice, an advocate for peace. Despite this, despite Jeremy Corbyn's unimpeachable record, the British media, the British political establishment, and the Zionist lobby have spent the last couple of years attacking him relentlessly and trying to smear him as either an anti-Semite himself or someone who enabled a culture of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. I mean, I myself have criticized his handling of the issue, but to call the man a racist or that he is someone who enables racism is utterly absurd and ridiculous. What this all comes down to is the neoliberal establishment, the British media, the Zionists will be trying to get rid of pro-Palestinian voices, trying to get rid of and purge the actual left within the Labour Party. Anti-Semitism is a serious issue, and it should be opposed by the Labour Party. Fighting against racism is a fundamentally leftist value. And that's why we shouldn't confuse anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, which is unfortunately what the media, what Keir Starmer, the now Labour leader, is doing. Keir Starmer himself has said that he is a Zionist without qualification. This man is a clear supporter of the Israeli apartheid state, and the last couple of years, we've seen not just Corbyn, but other voices championing the rights of Palestinians being purged, being kicked out of the party, being reprimanded, being suspended. There's a clear drive here to get rid of people who stand up to the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians by the Israeli occupation. Chris Williamson, who's also a former Labour MP and a close friend of Jeremy Corbyn, was also unfairly suspended from the Labour Party. Chris is a staunch anti-imperialist, he's a real leftist, and he's fought against racism his entire life as well. I'm joined by him now. Hi Chris, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me, I appreciate it. It's a real honour, thank you. I mean, I'm a big admirer of your work.
I really appreciate it, thank you. Chris, can I just get your initial thoughts on the EHRC report and Jeremy being suspended?
Well, I mean, the EHRC is a discredited organisation. It's a partisan organisation. It's been accused of institutional racism. It doesn't have any black or Muslim commissioners on its board. And indeed, two of the black and Muslim commissioners that it did have on the board were removed because they were deemed to be too loud and vocal about issues of race. They're very close to the Conservative Party, had a strong relationship as well with the New Labour Party, former New Labour government, New Labour regime, and they've come forward with a partisan report. I mean, I think the conclusions are written before the report had actually really, you know, seen the light of day, frankly. At the end of the day, they were trying to make the assertion that the Labour Party had a massive problem with anti-Semitism, that it was institutionally anti-Semitic. They didn't make that finding about institutional anti-Semitism, but they did actually argue that Labour was guilty of unlawful conduct and harassing the Jewish community based on two cases, two questionable cases, it's got to be said. They had six people initially in the initial report, six. And as a result of the legal representations that I made, they removed my name and three others. And they were left then with two people. And the way the corporate media has covered this is if this is some terrible, shaming revelation about institutional anti-Semitism inside the Labour Party, when it's anything but. I mean, even if you accept at face value, two people out of a membership of 500,000 hardly constitutes a major problem for the Labour Party.
I wanted to ask you more about how you litigated and got your name removed from the report. Can you tell us more about that?
Basically, we threatened them that if they didn't remove my name, that I would take further legal action against them in the High Court to restrain them from publishing the report, and wouldn't be satisfied with anything short of my complete removal from the report, because I was anything but what they were accusing me of doing. I've spent my life fighting racism going back to the 1970s, actually putting my personal safety at risk, confronting fascists on the street in the 1970s, and indeed on building sites when I was a young apprentice bricklayer, when casual racism was quite a thing in the 1970s in the UK. And I would regularly challenge the casual racism that I heard at that time on building sites, and, you know, nearly got beaten up on more than a few occasions. So, you know, I'm not going to take any lectures from people who are bad faith actors and attempting to try and, you know, smear somebody, you know, with my record. And indeed, somebody with Jeremy Corbyn's record, which is an unimpeachable anti-racist record, and yet he's being demonised in the way in which he speaks. Absolutely outrageous.
It really cannot be overstated how much the British media hate Jeremy Corbyn and have relentlessly attacked and smeared him during the last couple of years. I mean, to begin with, the majority, the vast majority of printed media in the United Kingdom is right-wing, okay? But even liberal left publications like The Guardian led the charge against Corbyn and smeared him relentlessly, and still are. Not even Ed Miliband or Gordon Brown or Tony Blair, the war criminal who destroyed Iraq, who has the blood of a million Iraqis on his hands, was smeared to this level by any of the mainstream media in the UK. Think of that. Think about how Bernie Sanders is smeared in the United States, except 100 times worse. Okay? Jeremy Corbyn has been called anything you can imagine. He's been called a jihadist sympathizer. He's been called a terrorist. He's been accused of wanting to abolish the monarchy and the army. He's been accused of a million things under the sun. So the mainstream media were not just complicit, they were more than happy to participate in this targeted smear campaign against leftists in the Labour Party, and specifically Jeremy Corbyn. It's not just conjecture, it's not just speculation or me saying that. This is actually backed up by raw data. A report by The Independent found that 75% of media coverage of Jeremy Corbyn was negative and factually misrepresented him. That is astonishing. For anyone to objectively say that Jeremy Corbyn has not been the target of a smear campaign by the Zionist lobby, by the political establishment in the UK, by the British media themselves, is utterly delusional and dishonest. But frankly speaking, these attacks don't just come from the Zionist lobby or from the British media, they also come from within the Labour Party itself. Even though Jeremy Corbyn won the leadership contest in 2015 by attracting a lot of new members to the Labour Party, a lot of youth with his anti-war message, with his populist message, this didn't change the fact that a lot of his colleagues in the parliamentary Labour Party are liberals, are Blairites, are to the right of him. They even tried to oust him in a coup, in a vote of no confidence in 2016. This vicious smear campaign by all of these actors is what contributed eventually to Labour's catastrophic loss a year ago in the 2019 elections. However, this witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn, against the left wing of the Labour Party, didn't stop after the loss of the election. When Keir Starmer took over, who again is a Zionist without qualification, as he says, and a former prosecutor and former British intelligence, when he took over, he continued to persecute the left wing of the Labour Party. He appointed a bunch of Blairites to his cabinet, and he interfered in what was supposed to be an impartial investigation. Starmer suspended Jeremy Corbyn not even 24 hours after his comments about the EHRC report. Again, Corbyn acknowledged there was a problem with anti-Semitism. He just said that it was blown up by the media, which is factually true. Keir Starmer suspended him, and last week when the National Executive Committee reinstated Jeremy Corbyn as a Labour member, Keir Starmer withheld the whip, meaning that Jeremy Corbyn is now standing in Parliament as an independent. So even though he's back in the Labour Party, he is not back in the parliamentary Labour Party. Chris, you were suspended from the Labour Party in 2019, very unfairly I might add, and now Jeremy Corbyn as well. Do you feel there's been a targeted campaign against pro-Palestinian voices or anti-Zionist voices within Labour?
Most definitely. I mean, the Israel lobby is all over this. I mean, the two complainants to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission are out-and-out Zionist organisations, the so-called Campaign Against Anti-Semitism and the self-styled Jewish Labour Movement are both out-and-out Zionist organisations. And there is no doubt that that was the agenda to take out prominent pro-Palestinian voices. It was unconscionable to them to have someone like Jeremy Corbyn, who was an anti-imperialist, somebody who was very supportive and sympathetic to the cause of the Palestinians, somebody who had set his stall out to implement an ethical foreign policy were Labour to get into office, and indeed had appointed a shadow minister for peace and disarmament. They took out Ken Livingston, who was a prominent anti-racist, probably somebody who'd done more for the cause of anti-racism than anybody, actually, any politician in Britain when he was leader of the Greater London Council and then the London Mayor. Absolute, solid anti-racist. He was one of the first high-profile casualties. And then people like Mark Wadsworth, a well-known black anti-racist who introduced Nelson Mandela to the Stephen Lawrence family and was very instrumental in you know, supporting the Lawrence family in getting some semblance of justice for their son. He was thrown under the bus. He was accused of being a bigot and anti-Semite. Somebody who's an out-and-out, you know, anti-racist. Jackie Walker, another vice chair of Momentum, a black Jewish prominent member of the party, an anti-racist trainer. She was also taken out. And because we had a unique moment in history where we could have had a socialist government in Britain that would have transformed the economic landscape in Britain for British right. citizens and tackled grotesque inequality, but also, more significantly, I think, in many ways, had an anti-imperialist foreign policy, a foreign policy that would have been incredibly sympathetic to and supportive of the Palestinian people and would have really held the rogue Israeli state's feet to the fire in relation to the way in which they're flagrantly disregarding their international law obligations and so on. That was unconscionable. That was what this was all about.
Why do you think they're going to such lengths if Corbyn's no longer the leader anyway, and we've got Keir Starmer, who's heading Labour now?
It's part of this maximalist strategy. They are absolutely keen to utterly crush any semblance of a kind of a progressive left inside the Labour Party, or the Labour Party being a potential vehicle for an ethical pro-Palestinian policy, and a socialist, sort of corporate capitalist party. And what they're determined to do is to create a safe opposition, I can put it like that, a party in Britain, which is right. essentially the flip side of the current government. You know, we've got two establishment parties that are two sides of the same coin. In the same way that in the United States we have the Democrats and the Republicans, which in reality yeah. doesn't really matter who gets into government. You know, nothing much changes, and that's where we're at in Britain now. And that's why I think we absolutely, in my opinion, need to, in Britain, be working to build an alternative movement and ultimately an alternative electoral vehicle, because I think the Labour Party is utterly broken. And what I've been saying is that the best thing we can do is to, the kindest thing we can do is to kill it and start again.
Two sides of the same coin. Overseas operations bill going through, spy cops bill going through, no opposition whatsoever from Labour. I mean, it's pathetic, it's grotesque. What is the future of the Labour Party? Is there one at all?
Look, Labour as a vehicle for socialism, as a vehicle for progressive change, it's over, it's finished. You know, Tony Benn, the great Tony Benn, great socialist, who best leader, best prime minister this country never had, used to talk about the new Labour cuckoos attempting to take over the Labour nest. Well, they've absolutely not just taken it over, they've absolutely destroyed it and broken all the eggs in the Labour right. nest. And it's impossible to put broken eggs back together. And we therefore need to, in my opinion, focus on building a new nest. But it won't be easy to build a new party. But it's not impossible. It's been done in the past. I mean, look, you know, back in the day, the duopoly system that existed in Britain, two-party system, was between the Liberals and the Conservatives, and then Labour broke through. You know, so it can be done. It can be done. And as I keep saying, you know, with solidarity, anything is possible. And, you know, there are more of us than them at the end of the day. And we've just got to give people confidence that, you know, we can actually make a difference.
Thanks very much, Chris, for your time. Really appreciate you coming on. I have to say, I'm in complete agreement with what Chris said, with what Miko said. Unfortunately, the Corbyn experiment is dead. Whatever chance the Labour Party had of actually being a vehicle for anti-imperialism, being an anti-war movement, being a party that champions the rights of workers, that actually fights for Palestinians, is gone. It has been taken over once again by the liberal establishment, by the Blairites, who are now working in tandem with the Conservatives, with the Tories, to promote authoritarian, absolutely Orwellian policies, like the Overseas Operations Bill, which legalizes war crimes by British soldiers, or the Spy Cops Bill, which gives undercover government agents the right to commit crimes, any crimes. This is absolutely frightening. There is no more opposition party in the UK. And whatever chance there was at having one is also gone. This shows us once again the reach of the Zionist lobby and how far they are willing to go to silence pro-Palestinian voices and anyone who speaks out against their persecution and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, who exposes their war crimes. This should frighten anyone who actually cares about having a democracy and about fighting racism in all of its forms. And anyone who is denying that this was a political witch hunt, that this was politically motivated, that this was a targeted campaign against Jeremy Corbyn, against his allies, and against the true leftist and anti-imperialist wing of the Labour Party, is lying to themselves. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Lecture.